So I'm chatting now with Darren Lewis, Daily Mirror's assistant editor, who's here at the university doing some talks with the students today. And I've managed to just nab him and get him into the studio to ask him a few things. So you've been working in the field of sports journalism now for over 20 years across various platforms, including for the Mirror and on TV. How did you first get into sports reporting and why?
I was a news journalist for something like 5 years, and I've always enjoyed sports. I've always wanted to watch sports, and I worked for a sports agency called Haters Teamwork, a couple of terrific guys, Jerry Cox and Nick Callow. So terrific, I couldn't remember his surname. what they would do, they would deploy students like almost a temping agency, where if there were experienced journalists who were off sick or unavailable on any given day, you go in and you replace them on that day. And I went in one day to work for the Daily Mirror, and they offered me a job 10 days later. And I, funnily enough, I actually turned it down the first time they offered it to me, because I was very spooked. I was very, I felt I wasn't experienced enough to take it. And if you're listening to this and you're in a similar situation, don't do what I did. Take the job, take an opportunity, embrace every opportunity, try and make it work, because it's the best thing I ever did.
That imposter syndrome is something we all kind of battle with, isn't it? So definitely take the job. As you say, over the years you've been sports reporting, there's been various changes, particularly in the world of football, with VAR being perhaps the most controversial. What are your thoughts on VAR? Is it good for football? Is it bad?
VAR has taken all the spontaneity out of football, and that's the thing I worry about. I don't think football should be an exact science. I never have done, and I don't think I ever will. Set against that, I do understand goal line technology. We do need to have that. We have seen lots of cases where, had we not had goal line technology, legitimate goals would have been chalked off. I think as far as VAR is concerned, what we do want is offside is obviously offside.
Yeah.
And we don't want situations where legitimate offsides are not given. But I don't like the idea of somebody scoring a goal, celebrating, and then seeing something chalked off by a decision that I don't even necessarily believe to be true in some cases. And we have seen cases so far where what we believe to be legitimate goals have been chalked off. I think I saw one last weekend, but I can't remember in which game, but I definitely saw one last weekend where I did think, I'm not so sure they've got that right, you know. I think as far as the technology is concerned as well with VAR, what we need is a more efficient system, because at the moment we have, and I can say this as a man of a certain age, sometimes we get guys wrestling with technology, and if we had people alongside the officials who were working on speeding up that entire process, I think it would be a much more efficient operation. But at the moment, it's all a little bit of a mess. It's all very chaotic. It does strike people like me trying to use technology and not doing particularly well. So I think we need to make that operation a lot more efficient. If we do, then I think people will be a bit happier with it.
Definitely. I think two or three times I've seen it where they've been waiting 3, maybe 4 minutes sometimes.
It's too long.
Yeah, it is.
It's way too long. Anything. I always think if you have to look at something more than three times, it's not clear and obvious. And they were the words that were used initially when VAR was brought in. And sometimes we see decisions made that are neither clear or neither obvious. Are neither clear nor obvious.
So over this last week, of course, we've seen some issues raised between Gary Lineker and the BBC. What are your thoughts on the wider matter of where freedom of speech fits within journalism and broadcasting?
That's a really good question. And I'll respond to it by asking you two questions. The first is, if Gary had written a tweet that was supportive of government policy, do you think he would have been in trouble? And the second thing is, can you remember anyone at the BBC being unhappy when Gary talked at the start of the World Cup about the issues in Qatar.
Yeah, exactly. I think those two questions kind of say it all and give the answer that there is, only answer.
And not only that, you know, Chris, I would imagine if you found yourself in a position with a platform able to have the ear of a huge amount of people, as you clearly do, you know, there are certain issues that I would imagine people would say to you, please, Chris, can you just highlight this on your show? You know, and I think what Gary raised that night, with that tweet, forgive me, was an issue that should concern us all. And because it's about compassion towards our fellow man. And you can talk about government policy and whatever else, but, and to be fair, we are all talking about Gary so much that we are not talking about the policy. And that is the thing at the center of all of this. We can't be unhappy at the when we see young people losing their lives, women, children losing their lives, but then suddenly be upset when somebody says something on Twitter that highlights the problem that we have and the approach that is being taken that needs to be examined and the language around it that we can't possibly be happy with. Because there is a lot of scaremongering going on. There is a lot of rhetoric that's being used that does have echoes of something very sinister. And I think the fact that Gary has had such a huge groundswell of support speaks volumes.
We're all human before we're journalists, is the way I see it. And so you're always going to have your human instinct before your journalistic instinct as to what the correct thing to do is. If people want to get into sports journalism industry, what are your top tips for them?
Well, just before I answer that question, I'll just go back to what you said a second ago. A lot of things have changed in this country as a result of people using their platforms to change the things they could, to say the things they've wanted to alert people to things they otherwise wouldn't have been alerted to. And I think it's fair to say around that particular policy and the rhetoric that surrounded it, because of Gary's tweet, because of the impact it had on Match of the Day, because of the row, a lot more people, millions more, became aware of something that they initially thought was something for the political bubble. But once the row erupted, people then started to ask, what's it all about? Should we find out? And if you look at the numbers, I think it's 60% of the population, the British population, watch Match of the Day in some way, shape or form. That's around 40 million people. If even half that number, say, became aware of something they hadn't previously known about, that's something in terms of awareness that is so important. And every person here within this superb building is working to raise awareness locally, regionally, and hopefully nationally as well. So we can debate, was he wrong or was he right? But this thing is not about Gary. This is about awareness. This is about understanding, compassion. There is a separate question as well as to whether in the modern era we really can expect people with a platform and people with influence and people with a microphone to be able to inform people on a day-to-day basis to leave their views about things that matter to everyone at the door. Constructive views, within reason. Should we expect that? If you were a female broadcaster and there were issues that affected women at this university that you felt they should be aware of, that you had views on, that you knew would chime with other people within this university, should you not speak about them? And to be clear, Gary was tweeting in a personal capacity. He didn't broadcast his views on the show. He didn't use that Match of the Day like a pulpit. He presents Match of the Day and he talks about the football. But when he goes onto Twitter, he tweets as a human being.
Yeah. It's his own platform. There, like you say, there's so much that can be said about this, not just about Gary, but the government and everything, which is way beyond...
What do you think, Chris? Let me ask you, I'll put you on the spot. Do you think that if you go behind the microphone here and there is something that affects people in Lincoln, in the university, should you not have a view? Or if you do a show, but you have those views, should you be allowed to tweet about them?
I think so, again, as you said, within reason. I think we should be given that platform. Nobody can say in this day and age that they are one, you know, not biased at all. You know, everyone has a biased way of thinking about things, so no one can say that they're 100% impartial. So this whole idea of impartiality within journalism and things like that, it kind of defeats itself.
I think it does. And listen, and we get it, you know, impartiality is important. We do need to have an impartial BBC. What the BBC does need to do is apply that consistently across the board. And there are other people who have tweeted about politics, some of whom work in politics, on politics shows, and without censure. Yes. So that before you can have impartiality at the BBC, you need to have consistency. And at the moment, they don't have that.
I agree 100% with that. So, bringing things back round, if people want to get into the sports journalism industry, what are your top tips? How did it all come about for you?
My top tips are going back sort of 25 years. So, I wouldn't apply my experience to them, but there are basics that I would suggest, and some of them I've seen here absolutely apply. In terms of the hunger and the willingness to work hard, I think if you want to be in journalism, you need to be reading the people that you want to be work alongside. Find a style. You need to be writing on a regular basis. You need to have a view about as many things as possible so that you can care, you know,
live it.
Absolutely,
like the great John Motson did.
Absolutely right. You know, the funny thing about John, I bore anyone who will listen about this, but John worked at the Barnet Press, and I worked at the Barnet Press. No, that wasn't at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, I came after him, but it's my tenuous claim to fame. But John was a journalist. John, that great Hereford game that shot him to fame. He'd gone to cover it, and it was supposed to be a 5-minute slot within, you know, lots of other different coverage. But because straight away, obviously he was sitting on the story, but the way he articulated it was so impressive that it became the big story. And he became the big player at the BBC in terms of football commentary, and went on to cement that position alongside Barry Davis for the subsequent decades. I think in terms of getting into any journalism, you just need to read, to write, to have an opinion, to want to inform. You need to be available. I was talking to a couple of students a second ago and saying, so your social life doesn't necessarily follow most other people's social life, if you want to, you know, this from doing this. All of these things are very helpful and very useful to you getting into the industry. And I must stress, you know, there has never been a better time to want to be a part of the media landscape, because there are some very good people who will be willing to take you under their wing.
And of course, if someone offers you a job, say yes the first
time. Say yes the first time. Don't do it like me, kids.
If there are any sporting legends, past or present, that you could interview, who would it be and why?
For me, it would be Pelé. It's the one person I've never interviewed that I've really, really wanted to interview. Just because I admired him as a player, I thought he is the supreme footballer in the history of the game. I know lots of people, younger people, will say Messi and Ronaldo, but Pelé was exceptional at a time when it was hard to be exceptional. And there were so many societal things that were against him. There were people who wanted to kick him off the park, and yet he would have opposition players applauding when he scored goals. And he won the World Cup as a boy. He was 17 years of age. So, yeah, if I was able to interview him, I would take that opportunity all day long.
And I think if he was playing today, he'd be giving Messi and Ronaldo a run for their money, that's for sure.
Well, on these perfect pitches with the protection of the referees, I think he would be absolutely... He would be trending on Twitter every day. He'd wake up, another Pelé goal.
So, over your career, what's been your proudest achievement when looking back at all the stories you've covered and why?
Do you know... The one that I'm most proud of is going to Switzerland and confronting the UEFA president. And the reason for that was that the England players had abuse when they went to Bulgaria, and the UEFA put a statement out, as they normally do, this is all very terrible and we will take action. But we knew at the time what would happen was that Bulgaria would be fined £30,000 or something very small. So my editor said to me, go to Switzerland. And I have a go bag at home, which has just got all of my travel stuff in there. So if I'm ever asked, I just grab it and go. And he said, get yourself on this flight. Let's ask him the question face to face. So I went and I took a photographer with me. And we got to the airport, we flew out there, and we arrived that night and we had a bite, and we decided we'd get up the following morning at 5 a.m. And we worked on a plan because we knew that if we had asked him certain questions, he would just say no. So we worked on a plan, and we went to the UEFA offices in Nyon in Switzerland. I'm sure I've pronounced that badly, so forgive me. And when we got there, it's superb. It was almost like walking into James Bond's villain's lair, you know, because it's a superb building by the banks of the river. And we go in there, and... The women were behind the reception. They were really nice to us. And we were waiting in this plush foyer. All the trophies are in there, gleaming inside the glass cabinets. And we waited for a couple of hours. And then somebody came down and said, the UEFA president can't see you now. And we were really disappointed. And he said, you know, look, he says that if you give it a couple of weeks, he will speak to you. And I look at my photographer and we're both thinking to each other, no, he won't. Yeah. And we eventually give up and we go back. And then a week later, I get an email saying, the UEFA president will see you now. And I said, brilliant. And they said, if you fly to Romania, he will give you a few minutes. Go back, fly to Romania. And... The night before, we get a laptop, sorry, an iPad, and we put some clips on the iPad of some of the examples so that if we say, what's your view on this? And he says, I haven't seen it. We can say, well, we got it right here to show you. And we show him on the iPad. So that morning, we arrived the night before. That morning, we go in, we sit with him, and this is the reason why I'm most pleased about it, right? It all goes according to plan. I ask him about what's he got to say to all the players who say that UEFA are terrible on racism and all this sort of stuff. And he says, well, I didn't see that example. And I said, well, I've got them right here. So I press play and we watch that example, and then we press play and we see another example of a player walking off the pitch. So he's got to address all of those things he's seeing right there. But that wasn't the thing that was the best thing about it. The best thing about it was that I had believed that I would get 20 minutes. We sat in there for 2 hours.
Wow.
The press officers left us to it. He told them to leave. He said, we're fine. And he went out there. And I've kept the picture of him talking to me as my pinned tweet ever since, because I was just, for me, it was such a good example of going to someone, talking to them, and seeing that if you do that, they are likely to give you more than you expect.
Yeah.
And it was a perfect example, because here was the most important person in football prepared to sit, talk with me. And we didn't just talk about racism. We talked about other issues within football. We talked about family life. He told me about how he's got two daughters, but very often everyone says you've got a great job and whatnot. And he ends up going home and stirring tomato soup by himself because everyone's out doing stuff and he's got to cook his own dinner. And he's just an ordinary guy, you know. We've kept in touch ever since. But I really have fond memories of that particular trip. It was expensive and I couldn't claim all of it back on expenses, but, you know, you can't have everything. Yeah.
So, final question now, because you've got a busy day ahead, and I could talk to you all day about various different things. What is your favourite sport to report on? Or have you got to remain impartial on that?
No, not at all. Listen, I the funny thing is, I love football. Right? I absolutely love football, but I do have other loves as well. I love snooker. I used to watch snooker as a kid. It's really weird because my mum, my gorgeous mum, she's a wonderful West Indian woman, but she loved snooker. She loved Jimmy White. She loved Steve. I have no idea how she kind of got switched on to. So I used to sit watching it alongside her. And then eventually I started covering snooker alongside a very talented guy from one of the other newspapers who kind of introduced me to some of the players. And it was great, great fun. And I really enjoyed watching it. And I find the funny thing about covering snooker is, in some cases, not all, but in some cases with the past generation, you found some players liked to talk about anything other than snooker, which was great. I also got to cover the legendary Ronnie O'Sullivan, which is a privilege in itself. So I do like snooker. I also like horse racing. I also like tennis. I loved covering tennis, the start of Andy Murray's career, the end of Tim Henman's career. So yeah, there are other sports that I like, but football is my main one.
I agree. I agree on that one. And maybe darts as well. I like
darts, of course. Yeah, I love the darts. Love the darts. But see, I I'm from an older generation. I'm not going to, I know you want to wind this up. So I do love darts. I do love the darts. But I'm from the Jockey Wilson, oh my goodness, Eric Bristow era. The current guys are terrific guys now. But me personally, I think there should be one darts competition rather than all the sort of disparate ones. But sorry, one darts organization rather than all the disparate ones. But I do love the darts. But I think for me, football's a game I fell in love with, and it's the game that's given me a magnificent 2.5 decades so far. And if you can get into it, please, please do. We need more talents. We need more younger voices, fresh voices. We need people who are reflective of the players who play the game, male and female. And the game is growing exponentially. So we need talented people like the people who are here to be part of the media core.
And you're off to go inspire them even further now. Thank you for giving me some time today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you.